Welcome to the podcast, Doctor to Doctor, with Dr. Paul Anderson, answering questions and discussing relevant topics in medicine. Welcome to the podcast, Doctor to Doctor. This is Dr. Paul Anderson, and we are continuing on in our podcast looking at some of our original webinars that are up on the Consult Dr. Anderson website. Many people have watched those, which is great. And over the years, some of the older ones we've gotten a lot of feedback on and specific questions. So what I do is I collect those questions, keep them, and then when the hopper is full, I put them into a podcast. This, of course, is a totally free podcast, and you don't have to be a member of the website or have viewed any of the webinars, etc. But if you haven't, just know that some of this material relates to things that are in the webinars proper. Now, we probably have three, maybe four webinars that either mostly or completely deal with histamine, and that's because it's a complex topic. It affects our whole body. And I just want to go through here some of the most common things that people ask, and then you can go back if you want and look into some of the histamine webinars that get into. So we have a peripheral histamine one and a central one and some other stuff. So I think the first one that I get feedback that makes me think, well, there's maybe a little deeper explanation involved here, is that you can develop signs or symptoms that are beyond respiratory, as we all know. But it's good to just revisit this information, because if you look into the literature, and certainly clinically you'll see this, there are many, many, many histamine receptors that are found, of course, in the respiratory system. Obviously, the digestive tract, our major mucous membranes, all have a lot of histamine receptors. And you want to keep in mind that things such as your skin, your joint linings, your heart, your brain. And so you can have histamine responses. You can be an atopic allergic person, for example, and never have any respiratory issues, but you'll get joint or skin issues and vice versa. The other thing to keep in mind is, and we'll talk about this a little bit later as well, remember that we have, as we know right now, four subclasses of histamine receptors. And we used to think that they were very discrete to particular places. So H1s would be respiratory, and the H2s were about GI tract. And then, you know, H3 and 4 were in the brain and all this stuff. And then it turns out that people who have certain types of atopic conditions, for example, overexpress histamine receptors of all four types sometimes in their skin or in their joints or in their gut or somewhere else. So this is why some people get, you know, eczematous rashes, and that's their thing. Some people get respiratory problems. Some people actually get cardiac irregularities and joint problems, etc. So it's, you need to remember, it's not a homogeneous thing. It's based on your genetics. It's based on the type of you know, problem that you have underlying everything, etc. So you can have a type 1 reaction that is not a respiratory anaphylaxis. Now, the other thing to keep in mind is that we have seen patients where they'll have an IgE, so a type 1 reaction to a food, and the physical reaction can be totally any of the above or all locations. I had one patient once where they never could get to the bottom of a cardiac dysrhythmia, and it was periodic, and they'd been, you know, scanned and all that, and we did the tests, and we found out there was two kind of high IgE reacting foods, and they had absolutely no respiratory problems, no eczema, no atopic stuff that we could tell. When we took the food away from their diet, there were two primary foods, they stopped having the cardiac dysrhythmia. And when we would challenge back with the food, the dysrhythmia would come back. So things like that happen with histamine-mediated problems. We need to remember that it's beyond the respiratory system. Now, other things get into this, and I will leave most of the depth of this to the various webinars that are on it, but when you look at somebody, there's a lot of things to consider. One is you can have a low level of an atopic constitution, but if it's not too triggered and you don't have a lot of respiratory allergies, say, that are active, you may not have anything. And then when you do, kind of the classic, like, seasonal allergy affectation, you'll really be affected. You also can be generally an atopic person then who has developed allergies to things beyond the environmental stuff, and now you have food allergies and other things. So you really need to look deeply into the history of an atopic, allergic, asthmatic, etc. patient to figure out how far of a net you need to go to check things. The other thing is you can get people with these IgE levels that elevate and they don't have a lot of symptoms, or maybe they have a lot of skin symptoms but nothing else, and it can be from activities of either parasites or other sorts of dysbiotic creatures in the GI tract. We get into that a lot in one of the particular webinars. But you need to keep in mind, if you're not finding answers, really do check out the GI tract. The other thing is you can get exposures to allergens that you maybe didn't know about or you didn't used to be allergic to. So as you know, with a type 1 allergen, you can develop both tolerance and intolerance over time. And the important thing about it to keep in mind is that if a person has a classic type 1, you know, they either get respiratory distress or anaphylaxis, or they body is covered with hives or something, you got a pretty clear pathway there that, you know, from a history point of view, you've got a type 1 reaction going on, then you can start looking at what was the trigger. You know, usually it's a food or something that they got into, bee stings. And remember that type 1 reactions can be progressive. They aren't always, but people can, be exposed to the latex family for a long time, have no problems, and all of a sudden start reacting to latex types of foods and latex products topically, et cetera. So it's just something to keep in mind there. The next thing to consider is, what if it looks like you have a potential atopic allergic person, but you want to kind of go, you know, you don't want to spend, you know, $500-$700 on different types of testing as you go. The first thing that you can do, and keeping in mind that allergic reaction sensitivity phenomenon is more than type 1 histamine IgE mediated problems, but those are the worst ones, so we want to start there. The first thing that you can do beyond history is to just take a check of total IgE, IgE like Edward, and you can then reflex that to other panels that are IgE specific. Now, as you probably heard me say on a lot of the webinars, we, in our chronically ill folks, we will do a total panel of total IgE, total IgG, total IgM and total IgA. It's not terribly expensive, and on a chronically ill person, it tells us a couple of things. One is, if the IgE is super high, then we know we need to work up down that road, and that's a piece of chronicity. But the other thing can be, you can have IgA high, which means more of a mucous membrane problem, or IgM, meaning you've got to hunt down where there's an acute infection. But the final thing that we look for on that is, every now and then you'll pick up an IgA deficiency or an IgM or some other deficiency or insufficiency, and we go into that in other things. But remember, there's kind of two levels of that. One is when it's zero or near zero, it might be a genetic deficiency for which there are tests that every standard lab can do. And you typically see those like on IgA and maybe G, which you do subclasses on, or M. But you can also have a functional insufficiency of any of your IgGs because you've been using them too much. So people who have chronic infectious illness, et cetera, will often have not zero, but very suboptimal IgA, for example, or IgM or G or something, or one of the subclasses of G. And if it's not a true genetically engineered problem, like a genetic immunoglobulin, you know, B cell deficiency, it's probably just because the system's been overtaxed. So total Ig testing is good, but IgE itself, if you really think you need to go down the road of atopic allergic type 1 reactions, do a total IgE first. What I will say is if they have symptoms and the normal range, one lab we use, it's arbitrary units, so it goes, the normal is 0 to 100, and anything over 100 is, you know, bad. If they're anywhere in 50, 60, 70, you need to be really thoughtful. There may be a problem. Now, the easy ones are when it's 300 or something on that scale. You know you're going to have to do some testing. But if it's not, but they have a lot of symptoms, and it's in the upper, say, half to the upper third, of the normal range, whatever your lab normal range is, I would highly recommend at least some screening IgE tests. Now, most standard labs, meaning often insurance will cover it, if they have insurance that covers their laboratory tests, and that's not the only thing to consider, but it's something to consider. Most standard labs have some pretty good IgE panels. And so you can get a regional inhalant panel, which is your environmental allergens. It's got most of your trees and grasses and whatever for the region you're in. You can get kind of a small, medium, and large IgE food panel from those labs. And then you can often, like with LabCorp, you can get a lot of kind of a la carte things. You can get like latex-specific things, mold-specific things, et cetera. So I think it's really important to keep in mind that, you know, if you have this going on and, you know, let's take an easy case. You've got a total IgE of, you know, 300 and the cutoff for normal is 100. You got to figure out what they're reacting to. And so by history, so like, you know, for example, if it was me and I came in and my IgE is high and I have a definite reaction to the latex family, because for so many years I used latex in medicine and now I am very sensitive to all of the latex foods, et cetera. So, you know, those are kind of a slam dunk because we already know I have a reaction, but it might be good to test me for environmental allergens and molds and stuff like that. And if you did that with me, and I say this because I have done this with me, what you would find is in addition to the latex family, there's going to be a lot of environmental things, especially mold spores and other certain types of pollens, et cetera, that come up. So, you know, it's a small, medium, or large problem. Now, the other thing is some of the labs that do other testing, so they might do an IgG or an IgA test for food panel or whatever, will offer IgE. And if they're paying out of pocket, those labs are often a little less expensive than paying LabCorp to do a whole bunch of their tests, their IgE tests. But if the insurance is paying, they generally like to pay LabCorp more than some of the other things. So keep that in mind. You go from kind of top down, you do a screening of total IgE plus their history. If the IgE is anywhere in the upper half of normal and they got a big history, I would test them. If it's above normal, I would test them. Now, another thing you can do, and there's different versions of this test, so I'm going to use the name of the one that I'm familiar with. The generic type of test is related to an older test we used to use back in the old days called an LHRT test, a leukocyte histamine response test. And that's literally where you have a bunch of wells with the leukocytes in them, and you put a different challenge antigen into each well, and you look for the histamine release from the leukocyte. So it's literally the leukocyte histamine response test. So back in the olden days, if we had something that there was no standardized tests for, but we wanted to check and see if our patient was going to be allergic to, you know, lidocaine or something, we could send a sample of lidocaine in and they would do LHRT tests and say, you know, yes, they dumped a ton of histamine when the lidocaine went in. So in modern times, testing like ALCAT, the allergy testing, ALCAT, is a version of this. And there's a couple of other labs that do newer versions of leukocyte response tests, et cetera. And people will say, well, how is that going to be different from an IgE test? Well, they can be quite different because this is a functional measurement of how you are today. So what you will tend to see, now keep in mind, this is still histamine release. And it can be non-IgE mediated, which is really weird, but it happens, or mildly IgE mediated. And so the ALCAT type test, the leukocyte histamine response test, will find these things. And so if we have somebody who's just super inflamed and maybe they have kind of marginal IgE and they don't, you know, they don't have classic atopic symptoms, sometimes just take the pressure off of their system and their body, I will do a LHRT test like an ALCAT, and depending on what I think they're reacting to, I'll add that in. So it might be the basic foods. You can also get certain herbs. You can add in, if they really like a lot of stuff that we tell them not to eat, such as processed foods, etc., you can actually do food dyes and food additives and all of this other stuff. And you can have panels that are all the way from very small to huge and wide. Now, is it the end-all be-all test? No, but it will tell you how badly the body is responding on a histamine level to all of these things. And I've had people where, they had small IgE responses to very specific things, but not a lot else. And when we did this LHRT ALCAT type test, we were able to say, look, you know, you may not be allergic to this in a type 1 way forever, but look at these 10 things that you are consuming or you're exposed to or whatever. They are very bad for you. They're very inflammatory. And that was often graphic enough evidence. Now, usually what happens is if you get the person's health online, you clear up all the other problems they're having, and they're getting healthier, et cetera, you can rerun those, and you'll see a lot of them have gone from very high to low or zero. And that's a good sign. It means the body has become less reactive. The next thing that you can do, as I mentioned earlier, is take a look at the GI tract. And usually what I recommend, if you got a bad case, is if they've had a prior, so if they're very inflamed and the IgE is elevated, et cetera, and they're atopic allergic or there's some other inflammatory thing going on, and they've had a standard stool panel and it was normal, or if they've had a stool test that was negative, but you really think there's either a lot of gut symptoms or there's a lot of whatever going on, what I do with folks is do some sort of biofilm purge and then do a stool test that includes at least three different areas. One is microscopy, the other is culture, and the final is a PCR type testing. And there's a few labs that do these combo type tests. You can use your favorite lab. But just the reason you want to do that with gut stuff is you're not going to catch everything on micro. Sometimes you catch nothing unless you're super infected. You're not going to catch everything on culture. You're not going to catch everything on PCR. So you really want to have multiple points of the compass. Now, what would be a good biofilm purge to do? You could certainly use like the Biosolve or Biofilm Phase 2 from Priority 1 or something. What I've used the most in the past is, because it works really well orally, is N-acetylcysteine, because it's a good sort of mid-level biofilm breaker. You can you could also certainly use Biocidin or something like that too, but N-acetylcysteine works pretty good. And I just have people take 500 milligrams twice a day for 2 weeks. And then I have them collect their stool at the end of the 2 weeks. And in almost all cases, then things that didn't come out before will come out. Now, when you get to what do we do about it, we get into this in all of the webinars in a deep way. And I just want to remind you of the kind of the rubric for this. So you want to take three looks into the histamine response system. And so the first one is the release of histamine. The second is the metabolism of histamine. The third is the binding of histamine. Now, the release of histamine is degranulation, and so you get into, like, mast cell activation there and all that. It's a big, hot, sexy topic now. That's really what that's all about. And the slowing of mast cell activation and histamine release is helped by things such as flavonoids. So in the natural world, flavonoids are used for that. The other thing to keep in mind is certainly if people are having wild reactions, then steroids will also slow that down. But long-term bioflavonoids will work. You got to remember that some absorb a lot better than others, and you need to just keep that in mind as you're using them. I tend to like, because they've worked for me, the methylchalcone forms like hesperidin, methylchalcone, HMC has worked really well for us as far as absorption, et cetera. And there's quercetin MC too, et cetera. Metabolizing gets back to every histamine talk that I ever do, so it's probably in every histamine webinar that we've done. Remember, you got three ways out. So you've got DAO, diamine oxidase, which used to be known as histaminase, and that is the one that everyone thinks is just in the gut, but it happens all over the body, actually. That's the one that you can upregulate through the use of its cofactors, such as copper and B6, magnesium, maybe a little B1. Then you have the easiest way out for histamine, which is to acetylate it. And many people are slow acetylators, and they do well with acetylation support, which is basically pantothenic acid or B5. And so we give these people, you start them off on 1 to 2 grams of vitamin B5 3 times a day, until things settle down, and then you can back off. Acetylation is like the emergency valve for histamine. And then you have that long pathway. And again, the detail I'll leave to the wisdom of all of those webinars to get into the long pathway. But what you want to keep in mind is people think it's a methylation pathway because the first step is HMNT or histamine methyltransferase. And it's actually not a full methylation pathway. That's just what starts it. The problem you run into is if you methylate the person and then the next steps down don't work, you now have methylhistamine in their body, which is much, much more highly bound when it hits the receptors. It's like evil histamine. So if you methylate somebody and they get hit bigger allergy response, it's not the methylation, you're not getting out of the methyl step. The next step is monoamine oxidase. So we have diamine oxidase on one side, different pathway. MAO gets involved. Yes, the same MAO that breaks down COMT, that works along with COMT, breaks down estrogens, and it breaks down catecholamines. Well, it also breaks down histamine. So if you're having a lot of overload and you maybe estrogen-dominant person or they're on exogenous estrogens, that's why that happens. Now, the MAO step is also supported by real basic things like B6, B1, and magnesium, a little bit of vitamin C, very helpful there. But then you need to remember the last step is an aldehyde step, and this is where the residue, the histamine aldehyde residue, has to get out, and that is totally a thiamine dependent step. Now, thiamine often works with NAD. So you could think about B3 in there too, but thiamine is the major responsible party for the aldehyde steps. So you want to make sure that they're getting a full complement of the B vitamins to make that particular pathway work. And then there's binding. So binding is once the histamine, so it's already released. It's not been metabolized out of the body, and now it is binding at histamine receptors. And that could be histamine receptors 1, 2, 3, and 4. And it is causing whatever downstream occurs inside of that cell. So binding, the blockade of histamine binding is usually done with H blockers. And we have H1 and H2 blockers. And as you know, or probably have heard of, if you have a big emergency that is a type 1 emergency, you will be generally given not only an H1 blocker like diphenhydramine or Benadryl, but also an H2 blocker. Like ranitidine or cimetidine or something like that, so that you're covering both sides. because as we have grown and figured out more about cell biology, we've realized that people that have big bad histamine reactions often have big bad responses in more than H1. So if it finally gets to binding, that's why in emergencies corticosteroids and histamine blockers have to be used up front, because one covers the inflammatory part of release and activity and the other covers blockade. So that's all the major questions around all the histamine things. I do want to just remind you that, you know, histamine is responsible for a lot of the proactive circuits in the brain. So if you have too much histamine in your brain, you actually can become psychotic. But if you're not psychotic, you can just not sleep well, and you can be angry and agitated and stuff. That's histamine response too. So you want to keep that in mind. Joints are another sneaky place that histamine reactions come up. Skin, we kind of know about atopic skin problems. The gut, we kind of figured that out. But the heart also is super sensitive to histamine. Now, in the show notes, I will write up and put in links to the webinars that this relates to, and then we'll have some other, you know, free written blogs that I'll put some links into as well. But that's it for this installment of Doctor to Doctor podcast, and I will see you all on the next podcast. Thank you very much. Thank you for listening. This has been the podcast, Doctor to Doctor, with Dr. Paul Anderson. You can find us online at consultdra.com. Consultdra.com. We'll see you all at the next podcast. And please remember, the views expressed on this podcast are those of the speakers alone and should not be construed as medical or healthcare advice. Thank you.